folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor and director Ewan McGregor. As a parent, the idea of letting a kid leave school with no job or training seems unthinkable, especially if that kid says he's going to come back an actor. You figure it's more likely he'll come back to live in your basement. Or worse. Ewan McGregor came back a heroin addict. Fortunately, that was just in his breakout movie, Trainspotting. Since then, he's built a hugely successful and varied career on stage, TV, and films like The Impossible, Big Fish, Star Wars, Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, Moulin Rouge, Young Adam, and many others. He can turn the most conniving, unpleasant character into your best friend, and your best friend into a song and dance man. Yet he says each new role raises the same fear. God, can I do it? He never struggled harder with that question than when he decided to take on one of the greatest American novels and authors of our time, as both an actor and a first-time director. In this episode, we talk about making American Pastoral, why he'll always be Danny Boyle's actor, and what he learned from Ben Affleck about the downside of modesty. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Ewan.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
It's going to be hard for me to not spend the entire time talking about motorcycles.
You mean we're not going to do that?
Well, I think if we start, we'll never stop. And
that's right.
Film fans everywhere will feel gypped.
Disappointed film fans.
Yes. No, but I want to say that I'm a huge fan of your work. And I have been ever since, I think Trainspotting was the first film I saw you in. And I just think that every time I see one of your films, there's a quality of just life and edge, and there's an enthusiasm to the work that draws me in every time. And I just saw American Pastoral.
Oh, okay.
And that's a book that I know well, and I'm a fan of Philip Roth. And you know, I want to talk all about that process, because not only do you star in it, but you directed it. And that's a huge first film to take on.
Yeah.
I think most people take on a first film, maybe they try to do a quiet little horror film. Or maybe a documentary.
Yeah.
They don't take on like the greatest living American writer.
Right.
Writing what some people consider in that category of the great American novel.
It's really daunting to direct a film, and it's why it took me so long to do it, because I've been talking about it for, I don't know, over 15 years. I mean, the first time I thought I'd found, well, I wanted to direct because I love making films. I went through drama school. Mainly, I did a lot of training, but it was mainly theatrical, really. And then I left, and I went early, in fact, in my third year, I went straight into a TV film, like a Dennis Potter series called Lipstick on Your Collar,
right,
which was shot like a movie. And it was single camera, and we shot it, you know, it was just like a six-hour movie, really. So I went straight out of theatrical training into 6 months of camera training, if you like, but
right,
you know, which was going to end up on British television. And it did quite well, it was successful. But from that moment on, and actually beforehand, that's all I wanted to do, was to be in films and be an actor in movies. But once I got on there, and I, you know, you do become part of, obviously, an important part of the process as an actor, but you can also choose to really get into it, the technical side of it. I've always loved that. I like the two halves of the brain working, the sort of emotional side of your character, and the imagining and making a scene feel real. And then the other half of the brain is like, okay, the focus puller's on a long lens, so I shouldn't be moving about too much. I've got to make sure I hit my mark. If I sit too far there, I'm blocking there. You know, there's a whole technical discussion going on in your brain at the same time as this free emotional side. So I've always enjoyed that.
You were drawn to that as well.
I love that. I've loved being part of the filmmaking process. So to want to direct it makes a great deal of sense if you feel that way. But I always felt quite adamant that I didn't want to do it just to say that I'd done it, or to say I was a director, or for any sort of other reason than I just had a burning story that I needed to tell.
Right, right.
And felt like I was really the guy to tell that story. And the first thing that cropped up was I was doing a play in London a long time ago. And one afternoon on my way to the theatre, I bought this little novel called Silk. And I bought it purely because it fit nicely in my hand. It was like a nice little book. It was like a little novel. And it was a beautiful novel about a man who lives in, I think, 16th century or 17th century France, who makes this journey. He buys silkworm eggs, and he makes this journey to Japan and back because there's a plague on silkworm eggs in Europe, and he has to go to Japan to find the worms, the eggs to make the silkworms, to make the silk. And it's a love story between him and this Japanese concubine and his wife.
Right.
And it's like, you think it's a love story between him and his concubine, and in the end it turns out to be a love story between him and his wife, and it's devastating, and it's a beautiful book. And when I read it, I thought, this is it, this is the one. I found the story. And I followed up through, I was doing a film called Young Adam in Scotland,
yeah,
directed by David McKenzie, but produced by Jeremy Thomas, who's a brilliant British producer that produced all Bertolucci's movies.
Oh, okay.
Really, it's like an auteur, a really great character. And he said, well, I'll produce it. And the rights were with Miramax at the time. Then they went to Mike Figgis. Figgis had been to see the play I was in, and I had dinner with him afterwards, and I was wondering how cleverly I could bring up Silk. And I said, have you got the rights to Silk? And he went, yes. And I said, well, I want to direct it. And he asked me lots of very clever questions about, had I broken down the script and where would you start the story? And I had no idea. I just thought, I have to tell this story. I can see it. Anyway, then the rights reverted back to the author in Italy. And he was interviewed. And in his interview he said, only a master filmmaker will turn my novel into a movie.
God,
and I read it and went, I thought, I'm not that master filmmaker. And all these negative voices in my head about why should you do it and who do you think you are, and made me kind of bottle it. I got the fear. And Jeremy said, well, look, all we need to do is go to Italy, meet him, and just persuade him that you're the right guy to do it, and then we'll do it. And I could have done it, and I didn't. I got scared.
Wow.
And I let it go. And then 6 months later, I was sent the script to see if I wanted to play the role in the film, just by the other director who did it.
Oh, really?
And I was so close to it in a way I couldn't do it. But it was my lesson there was like I should have done it, and I always kick myself like I should just have done it. I mean, it was made, and but it wasn't made by me, and I wished I'd had the courage to do it.
Well, I wonder if you get, you know, you talk about it for so long, if it gets harder and harder to pull the trigger.
Yes.
If you went through that.
I did. I was very scared at first. What happened with American Pastoral was I was attached to acting it for years, like over three years, I think. And we lose directors, like the drummer in Spinal Tap. We just kept losing. No one died, I don't think, but they kept falling away. And then we kept looking for the right director, and we didn't get there. And I got a call one day that the director who'd been attached for quite a long time had decided not to do it. And it was a blow because it had been over a year that this director had been attached. And I just felt we were close enough to the shoot date that it might not happen. And it happened already a couple of times. And it's happened to me in movies in the past where you just let it go. You think, oh, well, it's not going to happen, and you move on.
Right.
Or you're not even aware that you've let go of it, but you have. And then you don't follow through. But this American Pastoral, I couldn't let it go. I wanted to play the Swede so badly, and I believed in John Romano's script so much. I thought it was a beautiful adaptation of this novel, which is an amazing novel. But more so than anything, I just believed in me playing the Swede and telling that story with at that point Jennifer Connelly was attached and Dakota Fanning was attached.
And we should say the Swede is sort of the all-American boy who's a three-sport athlete in high school, and he's beloved, and he marries the beauty queen.
I think he is the American dream. He and Dawn represent the post-war American generation, but also represent the sort of the hope and the belief in this American dream. That's who they are, and that's what Roth was writing about. And their daughter represents the '60s and the anti-Vietnam movement and the far left, and who kills the American dream. And I understood him. I understood him as a father. There's scenes with his father, so I understood him as a son. I really got him. And I had to play him, you know, I wanted to play him. So when the film kept, it was like sand sort of falling, going through your fingers, I thought, shit, it's just not going to happen. It was at this point that my American agent, Rich Klubeck, phoned me while I was in New York doing the play, and he said, you know, you've been asking me to find something to direct, to look for scripts, and I think it's right in front of your nose. And
oh, so he suggested?
Yeah, I didn't even think of it. And I went, what do you mean? He said, American Pastoral, maybe you should direct that. And my first thought was, oh, you're right. And my second thought was, oh, fuck, shit, maybe you're right, you know. And so we had Mondays off on this play, and I said, all right, give me Monday. I was a bit like, it's such a big deal to take something on. And it wasn't because it was Roth or the... Because I knew that wasn't really my... Any trepidation isn't really that. It's just the... I had to know in my soul that I could, that I felt like I could do it. And I mean in terms of, you know, I sat on that Monday, I got up in the morning and I made a big pot of coffee and I sat with a script and I just spent all day really like reading scene and thinking, okay, can I do it? Do I see it? Can I see how I would like it to be? Can I imagine directing that scene? And being in that scene. And I just did it like scene by scene, like till I got to the end of the script. And by the time I got to the end of the script, somewhere in the afternoon, I was so excited about it. And I realized that I'd lived with this story for 3 years, and it sort of seeps into you, you know, over that time. I felt like I knew it. I didn't have to find how I saw the film. I already had seen the film. And I just had to trust that I could do that with finding the right people around about
right.
me. To make it happen.
Well, it's an engrossing film. It is. I mean, I have three daughters, and it was painful and sad in the way the best adult films are. You know, I think one of the reasons I'm drawn to films, the same reason I'm drawn to books, is I sort of accidentally take on the mood of the book. If I'm reading a dark book, I will sort of walk around viewing my life in sort of a depressed light for a few days. And I think that's one of the reasons we go to be entertained, not just to be sort of taken out of our existence, but to look at our existence again. You know what I mean?
But that's what his novel's like. And that's really, I really wanted the film to be like that. I think there's a temptation, and it wasn't in the script, but there's a temptation maybe in movies to make things too black and white, to make things too over-explained. And I love coming out of the cinema going, wait a minute, you know, with my wife, did you think that character? Or when you're thinking about it or discussing it afterwards, that's great. That I think cinema's about making us feel and making us explore the real world that we're in and what it's like to be a human being in the real world. And this novel is that, and just absolutely busting with those things.
I guess I wonder, when you started going through the script, I imagine you looked at that script as an actor, right, for a long time, and then you had to look at it again, like you say,
it's true.
As a director. How did you sort of change your mindset from just having to act in it and do that job versus telling the whole story?
I don't know that it's any different. The only difference is that you have the opportunity as the director to make the movie the way you see it. I think every script I've read as an actor, I have a whole director's vision of that film in my head.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's really just that it's not my decision to make it look and feel that way. So I then take my imagination of the whole movie, which I see, and I have to just focus it around the character as opposed to it being about the wall and the chair and the car and the shots and the music. And but I don't know that it's different imagining. I don't think it is. It's just that in this situation, I was allowed to make the movie that way I saw it, you know.
Right.
And that was thrilling. That was what I had hoped would be creatively thrilling, and it was. Every creative relationship was extraordinary, thrilling, like difficult sometimes, but amazing, you know. It's what I'd hoped it would be. I said earlier, I've always been that kind of actor. I like to be part of the movie making process, not just doing my words and going back to my trailer. You know,
right.
I've always enjoyed that. But it was really, this was my moment, if you like. I got to put the film together. I got to spend weeks going around Pittsburgh looking for locations, going, oh, that's it. Or this could be it. Nah, this could be it. And you're like, oh yeah, no, that could be it. You know, it was amazing. Everything you've imagined is enhanced, of course, by their skill and their unique perspective on their particular talent. Like, Martin Rua is an amazing cinematographer, and I was lucky to have him as my partner in this movie, really. And he was that. He became... I wanted a DP... I've seen too many first-time directors falling out or being bullied by DPs who are very experienced and are frustrated by the first-time director's lack of experience. And it creates a horrible atmosphere on set. And it doesn't lead to great work, I think. The DP always feels compromised. The director doesn't feel that he's got the right to his ideas. And I couldn't have that. I didn't need that while I was acting as well. I knew I needed somebody that I could really be my right-hand man and teach me about storytelling through... I mean, I've lived through camera shots for 25 years. I've been on film sets, so... I think in shots, you know, when I'm acting, I know what the camera's doing. Usually I know the size and,
yeah.
You know, so it's not new to me, but I wanted to learn how to choose those particular shots to enhance the story. And I needed somebody who was a storyteller. He made this indie British film called Harry Brown, starring Michael Caine. And it starts off with a frame of Michael Caine in bed, and it's the morning light. And Michael Caine wakes up. And then he rolls over and we go over to the other side of the bed and we see him. And then he looks at something, we see what he looks at, and we see that next to his bed is a picture of his wife who's not in the bed. So we assume maybe his wife's passed away.
Right.
And there's some pills. So we know that maybe he's sick and he's taking pills. And then there's a shot under the bed and his feet come down into the frame and onto the floor. And then there's a shot in the kitchen and he's making some eggs, and then there's a shot of him sitting, eating the eggs, and then we go out wider, and there's a wide shot of him eating the eggs. And I felt like in those, I don't know, what did I say, 6, 7, 8 shots, I knew everything about Michael Caine. I knew everything about who this man was. And there'd been no dialogue, and there was, I don't think, any music. It was just his image, and his framing was so beautiful. And it informed me of what I needed to know about this character. So when I saw that first opening of that film, I thought, oh, that's the guy, that's who we need.
Isn't that fascinating? I mean, that's the classic example of show, not tell, right?
Yeah. Like, and it is, it's amazing how it, you know, moving the camera, like, just changes everything. It's like photography. My daughter, Clara, is a good photographer. We could stand next to each other and take a picture of the same thing, and her picture would look like a great photograph. Mine would look like a snap, you know? So that's just something that's like a skill, a talent. And then... that's what Martin has. He just puts the camera in the right place, you know. And our discussions were, we spent a lot of time in the prep. We spent maybe 10 solid days going through the scene by scene, how I imagined it. And now I never did storyboards. I don't really believe in, I mean, maybe for action sequences, storyboards are a good idea. I've never liked to see them on set as an actor, because I think it's sort of a bit like, it becomes a bit like painting by numbers, you know, it's already been decided.
Right.
And so it feels a bit like that on set, you know. All right, and someone's going across the board and marking them off. And
got
you're
that
like,
close
okay,
up.
And you end up going, oh, we've got 5 left. And it's just not very exciting. But what we did is we went, okay, this is what I see in my imagination. I'd see him, that I would come in and maybe I'll be over here. And then, say Dakota, there's a scene where I come in to Dakota's bedroom, to Mary's bedroom. She's sitting on a window ledge and she has, I'm carrying a tray. I've just been given an award by the mayor or something.
She's listening to a record.
She's listening to a record. So I just said, okay, this is how I imagine it. Now, this is not how I want to direct. As a director, I'm thinking, I don't want to impose this on the actor. So when we get in there, it might be that Dakota doesn't want to sit in that window or doesn't feel right for her. And I would never say, no, this is where you've got to be. I've had that as an actor, and it's horrible. Sort of, it just makes you feel that you're not creatively as invested as you should be or as you want to be. Being told this is your mark and you go over to that mark. I mean, it's how some directors work, and sometimes it's fine, but mainly it's not. I didn't want to be that guy. And also, I'm in all the scenes with everybody.
Right.
There's only 3 days that I didn't act in this movie of 35 days. I'm in most of the scenes, so... sort of as a director, you know, it was a lovely, I hope they would say so, the cast, that it was a lovely experience for the actors because we were just in it. So I would say, okay, new scene, let's clear the set, everyone off. We're going to rehearse this next scene. and everyone would leave, and it would just be me and the other actor, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, so it was me. Like, I was looking for the director, you know, and I'd realize that it was me. And but so we were just to be alone. It would be me and Jennifer Connelly in a room, and we'd go, okay. And I'd always just say, this is what I thought. I thought that's usually where we would start. I had this in mind, and let's try it there, and let's see what that... And then we would try it. And if it didn't feel right, or if it could be improved upon, we would change it. And we did. We, as many times as not, we would change it.
Well, God, I would think that, you know, that you have had this front row seat to so many amazing directors in our generation, like Tim Burton and Woody Allen and Danny Boyle and George Lucas. And so I wonder if there was intimidation there for you, or if you had to sort of just say, I'm just going to have to throw all that out the window, or did some of these directors' words end up coming back to you at the right times?
I never had a moment where I was intimidated because of it. I just felt I must have learned an awful lot from all of them, you know, and from some directors, what I don't like, what doesn't work, and from a lot, what really works best. And but the truth is that once you start directing a movie, it's the work of a director is quite... It's quite odd and difficult to define, because it seems to me it's very much just about character, the character of the director. How, I mean, that's in terms of how they interact with people on set and how they interact with the actors and then the technicians. And it's very much just about who they are. I mean, you can't adopt somebody else's directing style, because somebody else's directing style is just about who they are.
Sure.
So it's a totally unique thing, and no two directors are alike, really. And so I knew that. I mean, just from my experience, my directing style is just about who I am. And there were some things that I, technically, that I adopted that because I know they work best. I said to the producers and to the first assistant director before we started shooting that I would rehearse on set every scene before we shot it, that it would be a private rehearsal with just me and the actors. And then I would bring in the DP, and it would just be me and the actors and the DP. And then once we were happy that we had this scene, because we would, the actors have to find it first. It has to feel like, it's got to feel like a real thing. So if it doesn't feel real to us, it's not going to feel real to the audience. So you have to find it, and that's about rehearsal. On the set, I'm not really big on rehearsing before the shoot.
Right.
Like a week's rehearsal, I'm not entirely sure I know exactly what that's good for. I mean, it becomes like a sort of table exercise, like you sit around tables and you read scenes and discuss them. And that's, I'm sure, quite useful, but I don't really like it very much. And I wasn't very helpful, I'm sure, to the actors in this film during that process, because I was just found it a bit scary. And I'm much better on the set. I'd much rather get up and try it.
What was scary about it? Just sort of...
There's the idea that you might not be used... You might not have the right help, or you might not have the right answer.
Right.
And, of course, the truth is you might not have the right answer, and that's part of it. You shouldn't have all the answers, because you're going to find out on set when you're standing on the location in the costume with the actor who's in their costume, and you start trying it.
And that's then it dawns on you, oh, now I understand.
No, that's where... If you want it to be magic, which is what I think it is, you have to. There has to be an element of risk it's only going to happen then. It can't happen in a rehearsal room. You can talk about it and analyze it, and that's important. And to different degrees, to different people. Because the one thing I really learned was that I suppose I've always known this too. Every actor needs something different from the director. We all have different levels of need.
Right.
From our director. Some actors are much happier to just get up and do it. Some actors like to talk about it a lot, analyze it, understand each beat of the story before trying it. And there's no right or wrong, and everyone has different, you know, some actors are all about the look and the makeup and the hair, and other actors about the costume. It's just, you know, it's what makes it fun and great. Everyone comes at it from a slightly different place. But that moment on set is where it really happened. So that was something that I learned from Danny Boyle, from Shallow Grave. I mean, we did have rehearsals on Shallow Grave, which was my first movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember rehearsing Shallow Grave. I certainly remember rehearsing Trainspotting with him, where we had a space with all the sets marked out on the floor.
Right.
And furniture, props and stuff. Like, we were rehearsing it for the stage, and we would rehearse that scene and move it around in the rehearsal period before the shoot. And then again, when we got on set to shoot that scene, he would clear the set and we would rehearse it again alone with him. And then we would bring the crew in and show it to them. And then
you're performing it in some ways.
And I think that's true. That's key, I think, for us as actors, is that there's something about performing it for the crew that you have the privacy to find it. There's nobody there. You're not being self-conscious because there's people watching you. And sometimes directors will have you rehearse a scene for the first time just with all the crew standing around, you know, smoking. And it's just not, you just feel inhibited because you're not going, you can't. And that's the other thing about, you know, behind the scenes people. Well, they'll just let them shoot the rehearsal. You think, well, then the rehearsal's not really a rehearsal because it's been captured on film. So it's, in the actor's mind, it's a sort of performance.
Right.
And that's, so you're not feeling free then to really find it. Because you have to feel you safe in finding the wrong thing. You have to do stuff that sucks, you know. It doesn't work because you have to know that it doesn't work by doing it, you know.
Yeah.
So all of that, I think, is best in private. So that was what I picked up from Danny, and I totally adopted that, and it works. And then when you show it to the crew, you know, you've found it, you've blocked it out as actors, you've rehearsed it, and then they go, and the DP comes in, and he says, then you go, okay, get the crew in. And then all the crew come in, and they're jammed against walls, and suddenly the room's full of people, and you have an audience. And then you go, and then the actors perform it. So they go, okay, action. And we just play the scene out. Now, it's not going to be like a performance level, but sometimes it is. And regardless, it's a performance of sorts. And I think that's quite important for the actors. We do what we do to have it watched by people. That's what we're about. And so the fact that you do it for the crew there, it sort of makes it... Because then when you come back and you split it all up and you go, okay, now we're doing your close-up, well, now the whole room is full of people and there's a camera there, but your brain remembers that performance where it felt real, where it felt like you were on stage. And I think that's really important. So I'm all about that. I love that rehearsal on set and finding it.
And can you feel the crew in the room? Can you feel when it's working? You get some feedback in a way.
Yeah, it feels good. You don't rely on it. I'm trying to think. Do you rely on it? No, you don't rely on their reaction as such. Because they are all looking at their scene with a mind to their business. So the boom
swingers, where am I going to put the boom?
Yeah, So they're not just. They haven't paid tickets. They haven't paid for tickets to come and watch it. So they are all thinking about different things. But
maybe you should try. Just charge them a little. Yeah, bit. Okay,
yeah,
everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you get to see
$5.
It for real, yeah.
You get to come in and see where you're going to put the boom.
But there's something to it. I think it's very important, and also it saves a lot of time, I think. And I've always known that as an actor. I've seen it when you miss that rehearsal, because a lot of producers don't understand it and they think it's wasted time. Like, to them, it feels like, fuck, the clock's ticking and
what are they doing in there?
Yeah. And they think of it as being wasted time. And then often they don't want to. Once you've rehearsed it, then just get the actors to make up and we can start setting up. But then people set up the scene without having seen it. And that just leads to time wasting because you put stuff in the wrong place. And
for sure, yeah.
But when everyone's seen it, everybody on the crew knows what it is. They know they've seen it, they felt it. They understand what the scene is about and what it feels like and also what it looks like. And so they're not going to put a chair over there or a ladder there because they know that that's, you know, it's just simple.
Yeah. God, the actors must have loved that approach and that opportunity to just sort of workshop it right there in the actual room.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I think about, it must have been, what, just a few months earlier that you had done Don Cheadle's film Miles Ahead, right?
Yes.
Where he took on directing and starring in every frame of the film.
Yep.
Which I spoke to him at length about that movie. And it's interesting that you sort of got a front row seat also to an actor taking on a director's job. Did you take away something from that film?
I did. I watched him like a hawk because I'd never been directed by my acting partner before.
You haven't?
And it was my first experience of that. And also, I hoped that one day I would direct, and I didn't know that maybe I would be in the same situation where I would be acting in it as well. And so I did learn a lot from Don. And first of all, because he's a great director, he had great notes, and he had a great eye on it. And I think the practical things I can say that I learned from him, because a lot of it is just, like I say, personality and character.
Sure,
and,
sure.
But I think just the how he would use the monitor when he's in a scene. So he had a handheld monitor, which was very useful.
Yeah.
So that if you're in a car, shooting a car scene, you've got a camera rig on your door. You can't get in and out without, you know, crawling over that.
Going right.
That. So just as a time-saving thing, it's very useful. Mine just invariably, I would get it in my hand and it would have the image on it, and as soon as I held it, it would disappear. It would go lost connection. And I would like, fuck, I want to break this thing in pieces. So mine didn't work very well, but I had it, and every now and again that was quite useful to have. And then I think I'm right in saying he would watch the first take back, and I did that. I learned that sort of, like, it's important
sort
to...
Sort of like making sure before you get too far down, too many takes that...
It just seemed like... There is something different in the nature of doing a take than a rehearsal, so things slightly change. So
sure.
I would do that. I'd watch the first take back, and that was a bit embarrassing at first, especially if it's on somebody else's shot, if it's over my shoulder onto you, and we're acting, and
you
then I go cut,
didn't feel
and I go, wait a minute, and I go off and check it. I know that you're sitting there going, fucking. My acting partner in this scene is now checking my work and going to give me notes. So there is something, and I knew that because I had been that actor with Don. And Don, not all the time, but a lot of the time would stay in character between takes. So, and he's playing Miles Davis, so he's very right to do so because he's playing this iconic guy. So sometimes I'd get my notes from Miles Davis. You know, and Miles Davis is not probably nearly as nice a guy as Don Cheadle is. So I knew what that felt like, it's an unwritten rule that you just never tell the other actor what to do. So
right.
A lot of actors do that, but they shouldn't.
Well,
they,
was that sort of your conundrum going in, like, how am I going to manage that?
It wasn't really my worry. My worry was more about, like, will I be of any use? Will I have the right help? Will I have the skill, which is a new skill for me to explore, of unlocking stuff for another actor to help the performance to be better. Or you don't want anyone in the crew or cast to feel that you are... Your job as a director is very much about managing everyone's fear. You're like fear management chief head of department, you know? Like, people come to you and go, whoa, I don't know if that thing in the garden's going to work. And you go, I think it'll be all right. Let's try it. Let's see if we can do it like that.
I think in your head, you're going, exactly what I was thinking.
I hope that fucking thing works in the garden. But you have to, and then with the actors, oh, I don't know about this scene. Go, okay, let's talk about the scene. Let's talk about it. You're managing everybody's, and it's everybody. It's the producers.
But who's managing your fear?
What about, and then you go home at night with your own fears and you have to deal with them alone, you know.
Well, that's the thing. I think in some ways, until you actually do that, until you're in that situation, it's probably hard to predict exactly how that feels to be in that isolationist position of being the fear management person.
Yeah.
But also having your own, like, did you have someone you could call, a director friend, or how did you sort of like work through it?
Leading up to it, I did speak to lots of directors, Danny Boyle and Eduardo Ponte is a friend of mine, Craig Gillespie is a friend of mine. So there's some directors who I know very well, who are mates, who I would discuss things with. Ben Affleck, I know Ben, I've had a couple of meetings with him for projects in the past. And I've sort of I don't know him very well, but we've stayed in touch, I guess. And I knew I needed to speak to somebody who was an actor,
right,
who had directed themselves in a movie. So he was very useful, and Ben told me, he said a very good piece of advice is, he said, make sure you cover yourself, because on set you'll feel there's a sort of embarrassment about doing your own stuff.
Right. Like, get it done quick so we can move on.
Yeah, or you don't want to be, you've done three close-ups and you're like, I'll have another one. You're sort of embarrassed in front of the other actors,
right,
to cover yourself. But he said, make sure you do, because you can end up in the edit room with just not enough of yourself. And if you're playing the main role in something, you need the footage. So just make sure you get enough footage of yourself. And he was right. There is a tendency to go, oh, that's fine, because it's your stuff and you want to just move on. Time is of an essence always on a film set. You're aware of the clock ticking, and you're sort of, you don't want to feel like you're, you know, favoring yourself. That's embarrassing. So you don't. And then what I realized I did in the edit was I didn't edit myself in enough. I was I had some people come to watch the film to give me sort of notes and advice, I guess, towards the end of the process. And it was a note that I got more than twice. It was, I don't feel enough of you at the end, in the last act.
Right,
I'm not
right.
feeling the Swede enough. And it was true. I just had unfavored myself, you know, because through sort of modesty or something. But once we corrected it with very, very small amount of work, just putting a close up here or there or staying in a shot slightly longer on me, which was, I suppose it's just down to sort of being modest or whatever. You don't want to.
But
by fixing it, it did change the end of the film. It did a lot.
But yeah, it's something a director who wasn't in the film would never even, it would never occur to them.
Right.
Right? They would just balance the story based on what they needed.
Yes. I wasn't able to sort of see it, I guess. I mean, editing my performance was not an issue. I didn't find it at all bothersome. I never look at the monitor when I'm acting.
Right.
I never do. I don't really want to know what it looks like.
Was that a weird thing to have
to
go
and do
that?
So that was something I had to change. I had to look at the monitor. I had to watch my takes back as I was watching everyone else's takes back. And I just had to get on with it. And I very quickly it became a non-issue, really. I trust my instincts when I'm acting. I always trust when I feel that we got it right. Like, you can tell, you can feel it in the crew and you can feel it in the other actors. And when you do the take, you just feel it's right. And I've always trusted that.
Well, I could talk about this forever, but there is something I wanted to ask you before we move on from it. I would assume that an experience like that would have the power to change the way you look at your career going forward.
Yeah.
Is that something where it's like, great, I directed a film, and maybe if another one comes along, or do you feel now like, I can't wait to make my next film?
I don't feel like that. I feel if you asked me, if you told me I was starting to direct a film tomorrow, I'd be like just full of dread, I think, because until you've got a story, like I couldn't do it. Like it took me 15 years because I don't think I could do it just for the sake of doing it. So if one of my agents called me and went, look, we've got this great script. You've been offered to direct this. And I read it and it was a great opportunity, or it was a huge budget, or it was a huge payday or something.
Right.
I still don't think I could do it because it's so costly in a way, directing. It's like carrying a baby for 18 months that you're worried people are going to come in and change your baby.
Yeah.
And it won't be your baby anymore. You know, it'll have red hair and not brown hair and blue eyes and not brown eyes. And they're going to change bits about your baby. So for 18 months, you're sort of like this. I don't know who you're scared of changing it, but you want it to be your baby. You want it to be you.
Right.
And it's so costly, like for 16 months of my life, this was it. And I had my family and my kids, and I was like trying really hard to be a human being amongst them. So the idea of doing it again, of course I want to, because I loved it, but I need the story first. I need to know, this is what I have to do. I have to tell this story. And until I've got that, I can't imagine doing it again, really. We did the Trainspotting sequel since I finished
right.
this film. So I directed, I was in that play. I became the director of American Pastoral, and I was on that for 2015 into 2016. And then I went off and did Trainspotting as an actor. And I would walk
Talk
off
about
set.
Full circle.
Like I'd walk off set and I'd go back to my trailer and I'd listen to the radio and I'd have a little nap and I'd read the newspaper and I'd go back on set and I realized how much time I had. Like it was unbelievable how luxurious it is to be an actor.
I'm sure it must have changed your perspective on acting.
I didn't.
What did you learn
down.
About acting from directing?
Well, I learned a lot, I suppose, about acting in a new way from the other actors. Being in a scene with them, with part of my brain going, what can I do to help? Or this isn't quite what I had in mind, and how do I get it into where I thought it? And it was very rare. I had such amazing actors to work with.
You guys did a fascinating, amazing job. It's really, really an amazing film.
Thank you.
You mentioned Danny Boyle a second ago in Trainspotting, and in reading about you and listening to interviews and things, you always refer to when you were starting out, you were his actor.
Yeah.
And it struck me almost like a band or something. I think of that creative time when an artist is young and they meet another artist and both are on the way up. I think in the case of Trainspotting, you had a director that was really figuring out his power at the same time as you had an actor that was figuring out what he could do. And
yeah.
I mean, do you think about that, about how lucky you were to sort of find each other at that time and work together? And
well, I can't speak for Danny, but for me, yeah, it was the most important creative relationship of my career, really. My feeling about being in Danny's movies, the first, you know, his first three movies, and that were my early movies, but in the time that we worked together then, being Danny's actor was defined me as an actor. I think it's how I felt about myself.
Right.
And I was in the running for Star Wars, and when he was making his fourth movie, and I still, like, I would have turned that one down to do his fourth movie. You know, I was like, defined me. And also because he was so brilliant, he's a brilliant director, and he got my best, I felt like my best with him, you know.
Why do you think that was? Like, how did...
I don't know, it's because it was my first director. I suppose he set the bar really high, but also just... he just gave you things to aim for all the time and sort of pushed, like, without you knowing it, just pulled this work out of you that you'd never have imagined doing, you know. Like the OD sequence in Trainspotting was like, I watched that and I'm like, I can't believe it's me doing that. Like, it's Danny just like eking out, giving you something. And the best thing about him was he always knew he was watching. He always knew that he totally got what you were doing. Like, he was sort of inside your brain. Like, he understood what you were trying to do. With your first take, you're experiencing the scene for the first time. And it's like sometimes the best take, I've always thought, not necessarily to watch, but to do, because it's the first time it happens. Like, you don't know what it's going to feel like. And
right.
It could just be two people sitting down talking, but you don't know what it's going to be like. And then you do it the first time, and then you've got a knowledge of it. So the second, third, and fourth take are, you know what to expect, in a way, even though it might change. So... with Danny, I always felt like he'd come in to speak to you after the first take, and he always got it, like really got it, what you were trying to do. Right. But he would give you something to aim for beyond what you'd been trying to, beyond where you'd got to, but somehow on the same... He might change the course of the scenes, but it was always with an absolute understanding of what you'd been trying to do. And I felt like it sort of built and built and built and built. Through the takes, he would sort of build... by giving you something to aim for. And so you never felt like you were just doing another take for the sake of it. You always had something to... So I always find that was something that, you know, I can describe about how he directs. But also there's just a sort of love in it. Like, I loved him, you know,
right.
As a man and as a creative partner. It was like I loved him, you know. And when I walked on his set and I looked over and saw him there, I was like full of happiness that he was there and that I was his actor and that I was on set with him. Like, I was in love with him, you know. So that's very important, and that's a sort of trust thing that you can't. That's just is there or it's not. And I trusted him. Like, he could ask me to do anything, and I would have done it, you know. So that also leads to like really expansive work, I think, because you just feel in good, safe hands, you know.
Well, yeah, and to have that at that formidable time in your career. You know, and then, of course, everyone sort of goes off and becomes solo artists. We get married,
right.
We have kids. And
do a few solo albums.
Yeah, yeah.
And then regroup.
That's right.
To do a tour when you're in the mid-40s.
That's on a cruise ship.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, were you able to sort of feel that again doing this? I mean, how was it different?
Well, it was different only in that we are all...
You all know what the hell you're doing now.
We really... I think that is true. The thing about Danny, this is what I learned from him, I think, is that he stood him in the middle of all these amazingly creative people, and he allowed them all to do their best work. And I think that's the best director. Not somebody who's going, no, you should do it like this. Oh, you should do it, but you start over here, and you do that, do that. No, just somebody that trusts that he's got these great creative people, but he's just sort of like a conductor conducting the piece, you know
right.
what I mean? Who allows everybody to play their best music, and he just makes them play it the way he wants them to. That's sort of how Danny directs, I think, and that's how he still feels to me, having done this film with him just now.
It must have been great to get back, because you had a pretty long gap when
yeah.
you didn't work with him. Was that,
I regret
do you have some
it,
regrets
yeah.
about that?
I really do. I regret it because I regret the films we didn't make together. Now, I don't know, maybe he wouldn't have wanted me in any of the films that he did make, and that's not really the point. The point is that we didn't... we sort of had a falling out of sorts, I suppose, over the fourth film, and it was a shame because we just didn't talk for years. And I was sore and upset about it, and it just stopped us talking, like, literally.
That's youth, right? Like to let time go by without realizing the significance of...
And I didn't really it didn't really change how I felt about, I guess you don't feel hurt unless you've got... Unless there's some real, you don't feel hurt by people you don't really care about. So it's just because you care so much about someone you feel upset, isn't it? So so that didn't really change, I guess. I still care for Danny, and he still meant what he meant to me in my career and in my work. And so just like time is a great healer, and all that shite was put to bed eventually. And here we were back on set together, and it felt really good. And it was never needed to be discussed or... It wasn't like a...
You didn't have to.
We didn't have to sit down in a room and duke it out before we go. It was just done. It was gone. And we just go on with it, and it was great.
You know what scene gets me in Trainspotting every time? It's the locomotive trains on the walls of the bedroom at home. And I think it's because when your character comes home after his OD and his parents take him back home and put him in his own bed to clean up, and you see these trains on the walls, it's almost like what you were talking about with the Michael Caine film, where there's this whole other side of that story that you get from some wallpaper. Mm-hmm. And I get choked up every time I see it. I just watch it again for this, and it just got me. And I couldn't help but think of your parents letting you drop out of school, mm-hmm. which blows me away considering they were teachers.
Yeah.
They sent you off in the world, and you came back, Ewan McGregor, the successful actor. But in every parent's mind, there's also the thought that they come back a heroin addict. And I wonder if you, like, if you think about that ever, like, what did your parents see in you that made them go, okay, we're gonna let him drop out and go for this dream that's a pretty low percentage.
I don't know. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. Yeah. I had to face it once briefly with my eldest.
Oh, really?
Because she wanted to be a photographer and... She was...
terrible idea.
At 16, round about the same age. Because, of course, it's a story now. It's like known. My kids know the story.
You can't say no.
My parents let me leave school at 16. So, of course, she's 16. She comes home from school one day and she goes, I don't want to go to school anymore. I just want to be a photographer and take pictures.
And did you take the bait immediately?
I thought, shit, what do I do? What do I do? Yeah. Luckily, my wife just said no. So I didn't really have to face it. I didn't have to deal with it, really. But she didn't really mean it, Clara. But had she done, I don't know. I like to think that I would have the courage of my parents. But I can only assume it's because they really knew that I really meant it. I wasn't copping out. I was never...
Right.
I think they could see that. I think maybe my school thought that I was copping out. We weren't allowed. You have to make choices, don't you? When you're in Britain, anyway, you have to make choices in secondary school. And well, I did know what I wanted to do when I was 9. I wanted to be an actor, and so by the time I got to 14, 15, and I had to make my decisions of what I wanted to do. Well, really, all I could do at school that felt good to me, and was interested in, was art and music. Like those were my avenues of expression, if you like. Sounds pretentious, but they were. There was the only creative things that I could think of to do. But the school didn't want me to do art and music, so they made me choose one, and I had to do physics and music. I had to drop art because, I don't know, they thought I was... They used the word copping out, like right. I was taking the easy route. Well, I just didn't... That just wasn't me, and I guess my parents could see... By the age of 16, when they let me leave school, that I wasn't copping out. That it was really that this is all I cared about. And a week after I left school, this was the other thing. They let me leave school without any prospects.
Weren't already in a drama school.
I tried to get a job at Perth Theatre, our local. It's 14 miles away. This town, Perth, from where I lived, had a repertory theatre. Still does have a repertory theatre there. It was the nearest professional theatre to where we lived. And I'd written to them in the past asking if I could work there or do backstage work or something. And they came back to me always saying, well, you have to have trained as a stage management person. and you're too young and you can't have a job. Well, I remember very distinctly, we were driving into Crieff and it was raining and the windscreen wipers going like this. And she said, look, I've spoken to your dad. And it was like we'd done, in Scotland, fifth is your penultimate year, sixth year is your last year of school. So I was in my penultimate year of high school, 16 just. And she said, I've spoken to your dad, and if you want to leave school now, you can. I was like, what? I couldn't believe what she was saying.
Sign me up.
I was like, well, I'm not going back to school then. That was it. I got to my mate's house where I was heading, and I went, oh, I'm not going to school. And he went, what? I said, well, I'm not going back to school. My mom said I don't have to go.
In the film version, we immediately cut to the car behind you at the stoplight, and then a backpack just flies out.
See ya. Boom. So I was out. It was like I'd been living in telly in 4x3, and suddenly my life went into widescreen. You know, it was like that.
Oh my God!
What? It was cool.
I mean, that's amazing.
And then that week, we wrote for called and wrote Per Theta saying, "Look, can I come and work? Because I'll do anything. I'll make tea. I'll work backstage. I don't have to. I can just get a job there because I've left school." And they were. Just about to start rehearsals for a passage to India, and they needed some extras, like they needed background artists on stage to be the Indians in the courtroom scene,
right?
And for scene changes, they wanted,
wanted the actors to be able to change the
scenes. Yeah, so all the stage management had to black up and put turbans on, and so that's what I did. I suddenly got a job. Got my first role. I was an Indian in a courtroom. I'd go in at night, get the turban on, and I had to run it. We had to go round the back. It was very risky for Perth Rep. Go round the back of the audience and down the aisles and shout,
you broke
cheer.
The fourth wall.
We broke the fourth wall. In my first ever professional gig. I mean, it's a lot. From there, I spent 6 months there. They kept me on. I was so green and annoying, I'm sure. I was working in professional theatre with professional actors and technicians, and I helped put the sets up and take them down and they would give me, they knew I wanted to be an actor, so they'd give me little, if there was a part, like, I would do scene changes. Sometimes the director wanted you in costume, so you'd come and you'd put costume on just to move a chair, but
right.
That was something for me. It was in front of an audience, and even moving a chair in front of an audience feels like you're doing something, you know. And then if there was little parts, like little extras parts, they would get. I was a journalist in Pravda, I remember, at the end, and there was this great actor, Martin James was his name. And every night he was playing the newspaper editor of the sort of sleazy newspaper. I remember, I can forget the story of Pravda, but there was a sort of sleazy newspaper office and a proper newspaper office. And every night in the sleazy one, at the end of the play, he'd walk up to my desk and he'd pick up this file that was on my desk and he'd go, it's rubbish! And he'd, South African, he'd throw it down. Rubbish! Shit! And he'd walk off. And he was improvising, but it was quite fun every night. I didn't know what he was going to say to me.
Right.
So in the very last performance of it, for some reason, there was some porn magazines backstage in this theatre, and I cut out a really nasty porn picture and I stuck it in the file. I didn't know. I thought it was funny. Like,
yeah.
So the Martin James is still walking towards me, and I suddenly realised, what have I done? What have I done? What if it throws him? What if he can't remember his life? What if he screws him up? I was suddenly terrified as he's walking towards me. I almost grabbed it from him, I didn't want him to pick it up. And he picked it up and he opened it and he went like that. And he looked at me like I thought I was in such trouble and he went, I like it, I like it a lot. And he threw it down and walked off. I was like, oh my God, thank God for that, thank God for that. So that was my Perth Rep experience. I was there 6 months
And
then went off.
Well, you have that thing in common with a lot of artists that end up going on to great things, which is you knew what you wanted to do really young and you figured out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something that's sort of revealing to me, which was that you kind of in your head, you said you were the guy that kind of never felt quite like he should be in the room or had some trouble thinking like, oh, I belong here doing Shakespeare with these great actors. I mean, did you ever think about that insecurity versus the confidence you of course have to have to make those decisions?
No, because I still have it now. I mean, I still have that, those doubts It doesn't get easier. It gets, it's the same.
Is that true?
Or it
doesn't
gets
get
worse.
Easier?
Yeah, every role is still like, shit. And I suppose it's what spurs you on to do your best work. The fear of it is part of it. Like, I know that from, like, public speaking. I hate it. I can't, the thought of it would keep me up at night. Like, I really, if I knew I had to do a speech.
God, is that true?
Oh my God, it's terrifying, horrible. Or play music live in front of people. Like, I love it when I'm doing it, but the idea of doing it is like really painful and stressful. And I literally lose sleep for nights. But somehow I've realized that it's just part of the process. Like, I have to be afraid in order to be good at it or something, I guess.
Is it almost like if you are not afraid, there's a problem?
Well, it would be, maybe you wouldn't do your best. Maybe you just wouldn't try as hard or something if you didn't have any fear about something. Maybe you just wouldn't give it your all or something. I don't know. But it's certainly, you know, I would, if I was in a rehearsal room tomorrow for a Shakespeare play, I would still feel inadequate about it. And I know I've done it. I've played Iago. I've got there and I love it. But I would still imagine that everyone else around the table is probably had more right to be there than I did.
Isn't that funny at this point?
Yeah.
That's when you have to just type in your IMDb page and look. You have to remind yourself, like, no, I'm good.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I never think to do that.
Well, I could talk to you for hours. Literally, I feel like I just scratched the surface. And thank you for being so honest and sharing these experiences.
Pleasure.
I mean, honestly, I think that, you know, we talked about two films and I watched 20 just to prepare for this. So
yeah. Well, I really enjoyed it, too. It was nice to get a chance to have the time to mull through stuff. So very often interviews for us are very short things, and you're just like, you know, 5-minute interviews. Like, what really are you going to talk about? So this was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I look forward to the film, and I think everyone should see it. So
great. Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Cheers.
Hey folks, that's our show today. Thanks for listening. And before we tell you about next week's guest, I just want to take a minute and thank you all for tuning in to Off Camera. We are having a great season, and with every one of these conversations I have, I feel like the luckiest person in the world because I get to sit in this chair and have these conversations with these amazing artists, and I learn something new every time we do it. And I hope you do too. And listen, if you have any comments, criticisms, suggestions, ideas, you just want to drop me a line and say hi, please do. My email address is sam@offcamera.com, and I would love to hear from you. And if you love the show, please don't keep it a secret. Tell all your friends about Off Camera so we can keep bringing you these conversations. Thanks for listening. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with Mark Duplass, who's been called independent film's most valuable asset.
After we made the puffy chair, it was much easier to quote unquote sell out. Like, we had some serious money offers on the table, but as a filmmaker, like, you make one bad movie and you're kind of out. This is not just, I want to have more integrity and be a man. It was also like, you could blow everything here.
With his brother Jay, he's produced, written, directed, and acted in films like The Puffy Chair, Cyrus, Baghead, Safety Not Guaranteed, Togetherness, and his newest project, Blue Jay. They're funny, oddly moving, and always deeply personal. Amazingly, Mark's found a model to succeed in making exactly the kinds of films he wants to make, virtually without compromise. We talk all about how that's possible in Mark's world, and the short film that started it all, made for a whopping $3. See you next time, Off Camera.